Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Powder Burn by William W. Johnstone and J.A. Johnstone. Narrated by Eric Michael Summerer. Chapter 1. It was a cold December day when Mike Lynch walked out of the gate at Arkansas State Prison in Little Rock. Outside, he turned to look back at the stone walls that had imprisoned him for the past decade. They had been long, hard years of bitter regret, not for the life of lawlessness he had lived, but for the fact that he had been caught.
"You're a free man now,"
said Ed Todd, the guard who had escorted Mike to the gate.
"Did that time locked up inside teach you anything?"
There was no attempt to hide the sarcasm in the question. Todd was one of the older guards at the prison. He had been among the early hires, so he had seen a lot of convicts released. Most of them returned to the life of crime that landed them in prison in the first place. He didn't expect much different from this one.
"Yeah, I learned something," Mike Lynch answered. "I learned I'd better be more careful so I don't get caught next time."
He flipped the collar of the ill-fitting coat up against the cold breeze that swept across the stone wall, and pulled the floppy, wide-brimmed wool felt hat he had been issued down firmly on his head.
"Huh," Todd grunted scornfully. "I give you 6 months, maybe less, you'll be back."
"The hell I will," Lynch shot back. "And you'd best say a little prayer for the lawman that tries to bring me in."
"That's awful big talk for a man just set free," Todd said. "Matter of fact, a judge might take that to be a threat against an officer of the law. Maybe I might take you back inside."
Lynch knew the guard was bluffing, amusing himself by trying to get his goat.
"I expect you'd better look out. Your mouth don't make a claim your body can't back up, old man. You ain't got nobody to help you outside that wall."
Todd smirked in contempt for the brash ex-convict.
"Big talk. Prison ain't learned you nothing at all, has it? Where are you headed now?"
"Wherever the hell I want," Lynch said.
Todd shook his head.
"Probably go straight to a saloon and spend that little bit of money the state gave you."
Tired of bantering with the cocksure ex-convict, he turned and walked back in the gate.
"That's a good idea, Todd,"
Lynch called after him.
"I think I'll go find me a saloon."
A drink of whiskey was not his first priority, but he had to admit it wasn't far down the list. The problem was, as Todd had mentioned, he was seriously short of money. On his release, he was given a suit of clothes and $10, then shown the door. He was a free man, but one on foot, with over 300 miles to get where he was going. He needed a horse and a gun for sure if he was going to make it all the way to Tishomingo in Oklahoma Indian Territory. That's where his father sent word that he would meet him. Jack Lynch, known more commonly as Scorpion Jack by the outlaws he rode with, had managed to stay one step ahead of the law in Colorado and Kansas for the past several years. He could not risk a return to Arkansas after he was charged with the murder of a U.S. deputy marshal and the two posse men with him. So he sent word for his son to make his way to a trading post he was sure to remember. It wasn't necessary to name the place, for when Mike was a boy, he had spent several months with his father at Lem Stark's place on Blue River in Indian Territory. Although it had been some time since Jack Lynch and his men had escaped from Arkansas, he was under no impression that the U.S. Marshals Service had given up on capturing him. For that reason, Mike was very much aware of the probability that he might pick up a tale when he left prison, hoping he might lead them to his father. With that in mind, he started down the road, heading for Fort Smith and the Oklahoma border. The sun was still hovering over the horizon when Mike came upon what appeared to be a camp on the bank of a creek. He paused to look it over before proceeding. There was apparently only one person and one horse beside the dark water of the creek. There had been no attempt to make the camp out of sight of the common road, and there was a big campfire blazing away. A traveler on the road would hardly miss it. Mike couldn't help grinning at the opportunity presented him.
I reckon I ain't gonna go without some coffee and supper tonight after all, he thought.
Hello, the camp!
He called out when he was still a few dozen yards away.
You got an extra cup of coffee for a tired traveler?
Why, sure, friend,
a voice came back.
Come on in.
The man got up from where he had been sitting and backed away a little from the firelight. Mike took a good look around as he left the road and walked the short distance along the bank to the fire. He felt satisfied that the man was alone, and he didn't seem overly cautious when a stranger on foot suddenly appeared on the road.
That's because he's been sitting here waiting for me to show up.
The thought struck him suddenly. What if, instead of the tail he was expecting, the man was a deputy marshal, hoping to pump him for information on where he was heading, and hoping he would lead him to his father? He would have had to leapfrog around him to arrange this casual encounter.
I sure do appreciate the hospitality, Mike said. I'm a little short of supplies right now.
He glanced at the man's horse as he walked past it. It was a well-built sorrel with a broad chest and strong legs.
A typical sign of a deputy marshal, he thought. They always ride a good horse.
My name's Bob Hardy, the man said. Be glad to share some coffee with you, and some grub, too.
He stepped back in a little closer to the fire.
Where are you headed? On foot like you are. Have you got far to go?
A ways yet, Mike said.
Well, set yourself down and help me eat some of this bacon and hardtack,
Hardy said.
Grab that extra tin plate there.
Smug in the satisfaction that he could see through the lawman's clumsy attempt to set him at ease, Mike helped himself to the generous amount of sow belly in the frying pan.
You cooked up a lot of bacon,
he couldn't resist commenting.
Was you expecting company, or do you just have a big appetite?
Deputy Marshal Bob Hardy hesitated a moment before answering when he realized that it might seem like more than a man would have fried for himself.
No, I reckon I wasn't thinking when I sliced off that meat.
He forced a chuckle.
But ain't it lucky I did?
You're camping a little early, Mike went on. It'll be a couple of hours before hard dark. I wasn't looking to stop for the night for a while yet myself.
It is a mite early,
Hardy allowed.
But I needed to stop and rest my horse, so I figured I might as well make camp.
Mike glanced at the sorrel again, thinking the horse didn't appear to be tired at all.
You might as well open your coat and show me that badge you're wearing, he thought.
Which way you headed?
He asked instead.
I was headed toward Little Rock,
Hardy said.
But I ain't set on nowhere in particular. What about you? You ain't never said where you're going. Must not be far, since you're walking.
The deputy was hoping to find out that Mike was meeting someone close by.
It's a little ways yet, like I said, Mike replied. I'm on foot, without no supplies, because I had a little piece of bad luck a while back. But it ain't too far to walk when a man's got a good horse and supplies waiting for him down the road.
This garnered Hardy's interest right away.
Well, that sounds like you ain't expecting to be walking much farther. How long you figure it'll take? Maybe I can give you a ride wherever it is you're going.
Appreciate it, but you said you was heading to Little Rock. I'm heading toward Fort Smith.
No trouble at all,
Hardy hurriedly replied.
Like I said, I ain't particular right now which direction I'm heading in.
If there had been any doubts about the intentions of his host, Hardy's eagerness to help him dispelled them.
I thank you very much, Mr. Hardy, Mike said. But I reckon it's best if I just go on by myself. I've got to cut off the road up ahead to get to a friend's place, and he's a peculiar feller. He's liable to take a shot at a stranger on a horse riding down through the trees.
He flashed a wide grin at Hardy.
I wouldn't want nothing like that to happen to a friendly feller like yourself.
He ate the last of his bacon and gulped the remainder of his coffee, then got to his feet.
Matter of fact, I reckon if I don't sit around this fire any longer, I can make it to my friend's cabin before it gets too dark to see. So I'd best be getting along. I reckon you know what's best, Hardy said. Hope everything's going to turn out like you expect. Thank you, sir, Mike replied respectfully. I'm pretty sure it will. He took the hand Hardy offered, thanked him again for the coffee, and headed back along the creek to the road, satisfied that he had the lawman hooked like a fish. As he continued down the road, the daylight began to fade rapidly as evening set in. His concern was that it might become too dark for Hardy to follow him if he didn't find a good ambush spot before long. A quarter of a mile farther on, he came upon the perfect place. The road took a sharp turn at the base of a low ridge covered with pines. Some distance beyond the turn, he discovered a game trail that crossed the road and led back toward the ridge. It was made to order for what he intended. He almost laughed at the thought. The path could well appear to lead to a cabin or camp on the far side of the ridge. Now he had to make sure the deputy saw him leave the road to follow the game trail. He glanced back toward the curve behind him. There was no sign of Hardy. He hadn't reached the turn yet, or he was hiding while he watched him. Mike wasn't sure how much of a gap the deputy had maintained, but it couldn't have been very far because of the poor light, and it was getting poorer every minute. He decided Hardy had to be watching him, so he paused before the game trail and pretended to look up and down the road, as if making sure no one saw him. Then he hurried along the narrow path and disappeared into the pines. Hardy thought, as he watched the ex-convict hesitating before leaving the road. If I had waited much longer, I might have lost him in the dark. He remained where he was for a couple of minutes more, so as not to be seen when he left the trees that shielded him. When he reached the narrow game trail, he took a few moments to make sure Mike was not lingering there, having possibly seen that he was being followed. Then he stepped down from the saddle and led his horse a short distance into the trees before tying it to a young pine, thinking it better to pursue his prey on foot. Proceeding cautiously, he followed the winding trail that seemed to be leading toward the ridge. The darkness within the pine trees made it difficult to see very far ahead of him, and he reminded himself that he had no notion as to who or how many might be at the end of this trail. What if the man's father, old Jack Lynch himself, had slipped back into Arkansas, and he and his gang were waiting for his son? I sure as hell should have considered that before I started, Hardy thought. His plan to tail Mike Lynch without a couple of posse men now occurred to him as a little foolhardy. In spite of the tense atmosphere of the dark forest closing in on him, he was struck by the irony when he realized that the word foolhardy, when split apart, became his name and fool. It created a mental distraction for only a second, but that was enough to cause him to fail to see the stout pine limb that caught him full in the face, crushing his nose. Mike wasted no time following up the massive blow delivered by the pine limb. Hardy went down on his back, stunned by the attack and unable to defend himself against a second blow that landed beside his head with sufficient force to break the limb in two. Like a crazed cougar, Mike Lynch was immediately on top of the smaller man, pinning him to the ground while he drew the .44 from Hardy's holster. With the barrel of the weapon barely inches from the unfortunate lawman's forehead, Mike fired a bullet into Hardy's brain. Straddled atop his victim's body, Mike listened to hear any sounds that might indicate he had been wrong in thinking Hardy was alone. When there was no sign that the sound of the shot had summoned anyone, Mike got off the body and proceeded to strip it of everything of any value to him. He was pleased to find that the lawman had a little money in his pocket. Still concerned that there might have been more lawmen following up behind Hardy, Mike did not linger. He took only a moment to consider stripping the body of its clothes, but he saw right away that they were much too small to fit. It was especially disappointing to find the boots too small as well. He would have hoped to trade them for the prison work shoes he wore. "Wouldn't want anybody to see me wearing a dead man's clothes anyway," he told himself. "Right now, I need to get as far away from this place as fast as I can," he announced to the corpse staring up at him. To confirm his original suspicions, he took a moment to reach down and pull Hardy's coat open. "I'll see you in hell, deputy,"
he said, when he saw the badge pinned to Hardy's vest. Back at the start of the trail, he found the sorrel tied to a young pine.
"Now I reckon we're going to see just how stout a horse you are," he said to the horse, and stepped up into the saddle.
With no thought of sparing the patient mount, he kicked it hard into a full gallop down the dark road, anxious to leave all traces of his evil deed behind him as quickly as possible. As he rode through the night, he reveled in the realization that, like his infamous father, he too had sent one of the government's deputy marshals to his grave. It gave him a sense of pride and a closer feeling of kinship with his pa. The sorrel was willing, but was soon straining to the point of foundering, and Mike was forced to let up on the lathered horse. With concern for nothing other than reaching Indian territory as quickly as possible, he rested the horse only when the weary animal began to stumble. He set out once again when the sorrel appeared somewhat recovered from the grueling pace. Holding the gelding to a steady lope, he rode on through the night, and morning saw the abused horse once again stumbling.
"Damn you!" Mike swore. "Don't you quit on me!"
He pushed the weary sorrel on through the morning until he came to a small settlement of farms. Passing through them, the horse began to balk, barely continuing until nearing the last in the cluster of homes, where it finally came to a halt, refusing to go farther. No amount of cursing and whipping could persuade it to move. Mike dismounted, forced to let the horse rest, only to have to jump quickly aside to keep from being crushed when the sorrel fell over dead. His initial reaction was to curse the horse for its failure. Back on foot again, he looked around him, not sure where he was, but thinking that surely he must be less than a day's ride from Fort Smith, if he had a horse. He cursed the sorrel again. It seemed a shame to leave a fine saddle, but he didn't care for the notion of lugging it all the way to Fort Smith, so he removed the saddlebags and a coil of rope and started out once again on foot. He had put several miles between himself and Hardy's dead sorrel when an opportunity to ride again presented itself. He had come to a section where the fields of a large farm came right up to the road he was walking on. At the far end of one of the fields, he could see several men working to clear some additional land. His initial reaction was to slip into the trees on the opposite side of the road to avoid being seen, returning to the road only after he was sure he was clear. Looking out across the rolling fields he now passed, he saw a house and barn in the distance. They looked to be located near the creek he could see ahead of him.
"Hot damn!"
he blurted suddenly when some movement in a pasture below the barn caught his eye. He stopped abruptly to make sure. It was horses, all right, a dozen or more.
"And just when I need one," he muttered.
He turned around and looked back the way he had come. He could no longer see the men working in the field, but he figured they most likely came from the farm buildings he had just spotted. There was no decision to be made, and no hesitation to head for the herd of horses in the pasture. Preferably, he would pick out a nice horse for himself and ride off without anyone knowing. But even if he was spotted stealing a horse, he was now armed with Hardy's weapons, so he wasn't worried about anyone left at the farmhouse stopping him. When he got to the pasture by the creek, he took a few moments to watch the horses, as well as keeping an eye on the barn and the house. He realized then that there was another house beyond the one he had seen from the road. It was smaller than the one closest to the barn. The only activity he saw was when a woman came from the house and went to the outhouse. While he waited for her to complete her business, he took the time to select his pick of the horses, settling on a flea-bitten gray that showed a lot of spirit. He shifted his gaze back to the outhouse.
"Come on, lady," he complained softly. "You gonna spend the day in there?"
It seemed an unusual amount of time to get the job done. When finally the door opened and she reappeared, it occurred to him that in that lengthy session in the toilet, there had still been no sign of any other activity around the barn.
"If I was sure you were the only one left at the house," he muttered, "I might take an extra minute or two and pay you a visit."
It was only wishful thinking, however, for he was in a hurry to get to Fort Smith. The situation was enough to encourage him to think about sneaking over to the barn with the possibility of finding a bridle and saddle. "First, I'll get me that speckled gray," he said. The horse showed no sign of resistance, plodding slowly forth to meet him when he approached. Mike looped the rope he had taken from Hardy's saddle over the gray's head and led the horse into the trees lining the creek. Having decided there was no one around to even attempt to stop him, he tied the horse to a small tree and proceeded to the barn, where he found a bridle and saddle conveniently waiting for him, sitting on the top rail of the last stall. He couldn't help smiling. It was almost too easy. He didn't even have to go to the tack room, where saddles and other tack were usually kept. And as he hurried back along the creek, his new saddle on his shoulder, he was almost of a mind to knock on the kitchen door to get a closer look at the woman. It was no more than a half-day's ride to Fort Smith from the farm that had unknowingly provided him with a fine riding horse and saddle. Mike Lynch had not been sure of the distance, but he knew where to go when he got there. So he headed straight through town and rode down to the river near the docks and the ferry slips until he found a battered old two-story building with a sign that identified it as Jake's Place. He figured that to be the best place to stay the night before heading out again in the morning for Tishomingo. Jake's was a popular saloon for men on the wrong side of the law, according to what some of his fellow inmates at Arkansas State Prison had told him. He was feeling a little less pressure now that he had gotten away with no apparent pursuit, and thanks to Deputy Marshal Bob Hardy, he could afford to rent a room upstairs and have a couple of drinks with some supper. He pulled the gray up before the hitching rail, dismounted, and went inside, where Jake Cochran welcomed him, just like his fellow prisoners said he would. Chapter 2
Will Tanner,
Sally Evening Star murmured, her usually solemn face taking on a smile when she caught sight of the lone rider leading a couple of horses down the path toward the house.
Gonna need more potatoes.
She put the pan of potatoes she had been peeling down on a chair and walked to the edge of the porch to get a better look. It was Will, all right. It would be hard to mistake the easy way he moved with his horse's motion, almost as if they were one. And he was still riding that big buckskin gelding named Buster.
Will Tanner,
Sally repeated softly, her smile breaking into a wide grin as she turned toward the front door to fetch Miss Jean. The widow Hightower, known more familiarly as Miss Jean, was in the kitchen, helping her sister-in-law prepare supper when Sally came through the doorway.
We got company for supper,
Sally announced.
Oh?
Marjorie Ward responded.
Who's the company?
Looking at Miss Jean, Sally answered,
Will Tanner.
Then waited for the reaction she knew would follow. Miss Jean didn't disappoint her.
Will's here?
She exclaimed.
Well, for goodness sakes, I thought he had forgotten his way to Ward's Corner.
She placed the stack of dishes she was holding on the corner of the table and quickly followed Sally down the hall toward the front door. At first glimpse of the tall, sandy-haired rider, she was immediately reminded of her late husband. Jim Hightower had always been proud of the young boy he had taken in to raise, and while she felt sure Jim would have preferred that Will would remain in Texas to run the ranch he had worked so hard to help build, at least Will still owned the J. Bar J. Actually, he owned only half of the ranch, since he had split the ownership with Shorty Watts, 50-50. Miss Jean was confident that Will's 50% was heavier than Shorty's 50. She suspected that that was the way Shorty saw it, since he was always hoping Will would return to Sulphur Springs when he grew weary of chasing outlaws for Judge Isaac Parker's federal district court. At the sight of the frail little woman standing on the porch, Will raised his hand in greeting and turned Buster toward the two waiting to greet him.
Think a fellow could get a cup of coffee around here, and maybe a biscuit to go with it?
He asked as he pulled his horses up before the porch.
I don't know, Miss Jean returned. The folks who own this house are mighty particular about who they share food with.
She smiled at the still grinning Osage woman standing beside her and joked,
They went out of their way to take Sally and me in, didn't they, Sally?
Will stepped down to receive a welcoming hug from the woman who had been like a mother to him for so long. When he thought about it sometimes, it occurred to him that Miss Jean never hugged him when he was a boy. This gesture of affection had begun only after her husband's death. After a brief embrace, Will stepped back and held her at arm's length.
"Looks like they're treating you pretty good here," he said. "You must be behaving yourself."
"We only get on her once in a while when she kicks up her heels too high,"
Marjorie Ward teased as she stepped out the door to join them.
"How are you doing, Will?"
"Can't complain," Will replied. "I brought a couple more horses to put with my others while I've got a little free time. I might have more than Henry and Hank want to fool with now, about 14 if I've got my figures right. These two ought to make 16. So if things at the courthouse stay pretty quiet till after Christmas, I'm thinking about moving my horses down to the J-Bar-J."
Marjorie's husband, Henry, was a farmer and not into the business of raising cattle and horses, so Will figured he'd welcome the chance to rid himself of the care of Will's growing horse herd.
"I'm sure it's all right with Henry if you leave them here for as long as you need to," Marjorie said. "My daughter's boys, Jimmy and Thomas, have sort of taken over the job of looking after the horses. Keeps them out of mischief."
"Well, I surely do appreciate it," Will said.
"You'd best take care of your horses now," Marjorie said. "We're getting ready to put supper on the table as soon as Sally cooks the potatoes. Henry and the menfolk will be showing up to eat before long, and you don't want to get left out."
"Yes, ma'am. I'll get right to it."
He stepped up into the saddle and turned his horses toward the barn and the pasture behind it. There were two houses built close beside Sawyer's Creek. The larger one belonged to Henry Ward, Jr., and was home to him, his wife, Marjorie, and their son, Henry III, who was called Hank. Hank was nearing his 35th birthday and had never married. The smaller cabin belonged to Henry and Marjorie's daughter, Helen, her husband, Jim Smithwick, and their two teenage boys. The Ward and Smithwick families farmed a rich piece of land just under 400 acres in size. Will couldn't help admiring the success the two families had enjoyed as he led his horses to the barn where he would leave his saddle. After that, he turned them loose to graze with his other horses in a 6-acre pasture behind the barn. He stood there for a few minutes, watching Buster as the big buckskin trotted to the creek to drink. Then he walked out into the pasture a little way to look over the rest of his horses where they were bunched together near the creek. They were all good stock, for he kept only the good ones, and all had been acquired through the arrests of outlaws, many of whom were killed in the process. Just as a matter of habit, he started counting the horses. Coming up one short, he counted them again, but could still count only 15, not counting Buster. "Maybe," he thought, "one of the boys is riding one." He shrugged and turned to walk back to the house. As he walked, he realized which horse was missing. It was a flea-bitten gray that he had been especially impressed by. A strong, sturdy horse, and he was not surprised that one of the boys would pick the gray to ride. Even though the two families lived in their separate houses, they still maintained a tradition of eating supper together at the main house. So the evening meal was a noisy occasion that always fascinated Will on his infrequent visits. This evening was no different, and Will was greeted warmly by the men of the two families. After supper, when the young boys left the older folks to sit and talk while the coffee was finished up, Will told Henry about his plans to move his horses to Texas.
"I reckon you didn't think I was ever going to take them off your hands," he said. "They ain't been no trouble at all." Jim Smithwick spoke up. "You don't need to be in a hurry to move them. Jimmy and Thomas have been watching them."
"Appreciate that, Jim," Will said. "Tell you the truth, I was thinking about letting your boys pick a horse out of the herd for their own. I figure I owe them at least that much for taking care of them. I noticed one of the horses wasn't there, so maybe somebody already picked a favorite, that flea-bitten gray. I ain't surprised. That's the one I would have picked myself."
His statement was met with blank stares. Then Hank spoke.
"I didn't think anybody had cut out any of those horses to ride. Have they, Jim?"
"No, not that I know of," Jim replied.
He looked at Will. You say that gray is...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?